We're going to start virtually on time. Do I have to lift it? Does this amplify as well as record? Yeah, okay. But I'll just hold it. My name is Michael Reich. I'm the director of the Institute for Research on Labor and Employment, which is basically this building. And I want to welcome everybody. I want to say a little bit about the Institute and for those of you who aren't familiar with it, and then kind of do a little more welcome in terms of the conference, turn it over to Dick Walker, who's actually the chair of our planning committee, who will say a few words. And I'm also going to recognize a couple of our staff who have worked so hard to organize it, who will give you some housekeeping details for the day. And then we'll go right into our first session, which it turns out I'm chairing, a random event, that is, anyway. That part. So the Institute was founded in 1945, so we're 65 years old. It used to be called the Institute of Industrial Relations, and we've changed the name to become more up to date, basically. It's been a distinguished institute since its beginning. In 1947, for example, it held its first labor management conference, and there were so many people there, it had to be held in the basketball gymnasium. You know, about 1,000 people, which tells you something about how different the times are today than they were then. So but we've continued to evolve and conduct a lot of work on research, on especially on low-wage labor markets, healthcare, immigration, anything really that has to do with the world of work. We support a lot of faculty. We have something like 65, I think, faculty affiliates from all over the campus. We give them research support. We have a Center for Labor Research and Education that's outstanding. That was, by the way, we were created by an act of the state legislature and also given some funding dedicated to us. And then in 1964, the legislature all created the Center for Labor Research and Education. We have a number of other important centers, including one on California public employees and others that have to do with childcare, workers, and a variety of other topics. The two most recent centers are one on employment in the green economy, obviously an important topic as we go forward, and a research center on wage and employment dynamics. Yeah, wage and employment dynamics. You can look on our website, which is behind me on the screen. It's www.early.berkeley.edu, and you'll see, if you can see through my head, that the website has featured for the last few months. A lot of the research has been done around here on the jobs issue and the jobs crisis. And there's also hard copies of this front page available by the door, which you can get during the coffee breaks if you want to take it home. And it then guides you through all the different things we do. There's also some of my work out there too. So, I also hope that we can revive in the next year the statewide programs that we do, providing we have a sympathetic governor, and we get the funding restored that we have lost a lot of over the last several years. And that statewide program includes a dissertation grants competition for all the 10 campuses of the University of California. I'm not promising that's going to happen. The election hasn't even occurred, but it's a gleam in my eye anyway. All right, so there, we have a lot of distinguished people here today, and some of them from outside of California. So I welcome travelers from outside of California. You have to know that this is a state where the sun shines most of the time, not today, where we vote on marijuana initiatives, as well as whether democracy, i.e. 50% plus one vote, should decide the state budget. Those are both on the initiative for Tuesday, on the ballot for Tuesday. And where the polls show that California is continuing to go in the opposite direction from the rest of the country. That is to the left. So we're that's, of course, interesting. On the other hand, we have had in the state now 20 consecutive months, as Sylvia Allegretto reminded me the other day, of double-digit unemployment. That's an amazing figure, 12.5%, the third or fourth highest in the country. I think it's that high because we have some of the weakest mortgage regulations, housing market regulations of any state in the United States. So that's a story we might get into later. So let me tell you how the conference came about, and I'll hand it over to Dick Walker. Or Dick can tell us. Okay.
Do I have to use this funny little thing? Can I just talk?
Embarrass somebody.
But try to keep the expletives down to a minimum.
That's just what Rob Johnson said yesterday at a similar meeting.
Can I make an announcement before you go into this event?
Sure, go ahead.
Okay. Please, okay. I don't need a microphone because it doesn't have to be taken. Just some housekeeping things for all of you. There's two bathrooms downstairs in the hallway as you go out the door to your left. There's extra men's bathrooms on the second floor. Once you get the landing, you go to the right, and the second door on the right. The women's is on the third floor. Don't ask me why. And you go to the right and make a right turn. If you're going to use your cell phone, please use it outside. There's working people in the lobby. If it's raining, please use your cell phone in the conference area where the food is. Please, as I told you before, put lids on your coffee cups if you're going to bring them in here. Parking. Berkeley's very well known for issuing parking tickets, so if any of you park on your yourself side, please be cognizant that if you don't go in and feed your meter, you will get a $40 ticket. Lunch will be served buffet style in the conference room where you were, as well as dinner. Myra and I will introduce Myra, that will be available if you have any questions. The front desk does not have change, so please, if you need change, don't go to Margaret and ask her for change. She doesn't have any change. The other thing that really is important for us, we're feeding all of you guys, but it's important for us to keep a tally of who was here. So in the conference room, there are two sign-in sheets. Please be sure that during the day, your name is on one of them. You don't need to sign both, just on one of them. We would really appreciate it. And if any of you are presenters for the afternoon sessions, you need to talk to Robert Hiramoto, who's the IT person, to be sure that your presentation is on our computer so you can put it on the, and you should do that at lunchtime. Okay, I think that was it for me. Thank you.
Thank you, Adija. Anything else? Myra, did you?
Myra will be right back.
Myra, okay, you've covered the topics. Okay,
very quickly, just to say, I'm delighted to see you all here. I'm delighted that this has come together. The intention here was to join two interests in the Institute, the longstanding interest in unemployment, in employment, and of course the condition of the workers of California who are facing this absolutely devastating unemployment and underemployment here in the Great Recession. So that combined with a project of the California Studies Center led by Gray Brecken and myself, the California Living New Deal, where we are digging up and unearthing and documenting all the New Deal projects that were built in California, which number in the hundreds and even thousands, and which we hope to take national eventually. And the point of doing that is partly, of course, historical, because we like the history, but mostly as a lesson, as an object lesson in American politics, because in the age of neoliberalism, everybody's forgotten how much good the government can do. And bringing this conference together to discuss why we're in the Great Recession, what the New Deal did and how it responded to the Great Depression, what the Obama administration has and has not done, and also about the political forces at work today that might improve things or not. I think it promises to be a very stimulating discussion, hopefully not too pessimistic. But as a great devotee of Franklin Roosevelt and the New Deal, one has a lot of reasons to be depressed now. But anyway, just on the format, we kept this small, and we kept the intervention short because this is not a conventional conference where we wanted research reports at great length. What we want is discussion. And so the people up here and the panels are meant to lead off discussion, but we want everybody to participate, chip in. We have lots of time for discussion, half the time of every session. So please feel free to get your two bits in, and we want a dialogue between all the participants and all the audience over these very crucial issues of what's going wrong and what could be done about it. Thanks very much.
Okay. Thank you, Dick. That was great. I also want to add that we do hope to have a follow-up conference to this one and see this as a way to build toward a full-fledged research conference with papers. And so in each of the sessions, we'll be reserving some time to talk about what are some good research topics and papers that have been identified through our discussion or through the presentations and so on. So you'll see that in each session, I hope, anyway. All right. Our first session is about the present crisis. Yeah, present crisis. I guess crisis refers to something more than a business cycle, normal business cycle. It means that we're in a protracted period, as I would suggest or argue, began well before the fall or December of 2007 in terms of economic growth indicators. It was already present in the weak recovery after 2001. And it's also, of course, revealed in the pretty anemic recovery we've had since. Today, the last the GDP flash report came out, 2% growth, which is, I think, higher than we've had, but still way below what it ought to be. Thank you, Dean. you probably put that out on the blog somewhere already, right? Good for you. 0.6% final demand. I guess that means the inventory. Well, okay. We'll come up. We'll discuss that stuff later in the day, probably. we have four distinguished speakers, and their topics. I'm not going to try to give titles to their papers, but we are certainly going to cover the housing market, financial institutions, and several of the papers, financial reform. And so on. I'll just introduce each of the speakers now so they can then go in order and we won't have to break it up then. And then we'll have the discussion after all four of them are done. And they're going to be limited to 15 minutes each. So in order, Neil Flickstein is from the sociology department at Berkeley. He's got some named chair, I forget what it is, but that means he's important. He's also had an enormous productivity, quite a few important books on economic organization, including the organization of the corporation, and he chairs a center that we have here on culture, commitment, and organization and products, politics, right. CCOP is how I always think about it.
Thank you, Mike.
and he's been working on the banking and mortgage crises recently, supported by a grant from the Tobin Project, as well as by us. Tobin, as in James Tobin, the great macroeconomist of the second half of the 20th century. John Quigley will speak after him. He's also one of our locals and has a chair, the Don Ternan chair, I think it is, Don Ternan chair. John has a very distinguished list of publications, especially in the area of housing, over many decades. I remember John way back in graduate school when he was wearing, I think, an Air Force uniform or something like that. So he has all kinds of interesting background, and he's been president of the I think I can get the words right, Real Estate and Urban Economics Association, right?
Close enough.
And looking online, I found out he's also been on the advisory board to Fannie Mae, but he seems to have either left or been told to leave as of 2008. So on my left are our outside agitators. Doug Henwood is the publisher of the Left Business Observer, which is widely read, has been for, what, about 15 years, I
25.
Think? 25 years.
Almost.
All right. We all lose track of time as we age. He also does a weekly, I think, show on WBAI in New York, Pacifica Station, and KPFA, I know it appears here, and you've got one tomorrow, probably. He majored in English and has several English degrees, which I guess has made his not only his writing but his thinking clearer than most economists. So he'll be third. And fourth, Robert Johnson, also a very wide-ranging background. He's says on the program he's with Global Finance Program at the Roosevelt Institute, which is based in New York. But he's also the chief or director, I guess, of INET, the Institute for New Economic Thinking, which is a very important initiative funded by George Soros quite well, and which has already begun an interesting set of programs, a major international conference last year, just did a first round of grants and as many other things in the works. Looking at his background, he had been chief economist for the Senate Banking Committee for a long time. He's worked at hedge funds, right? And what intrigued me the most is he's on the advisory board for the Baseball Hall of Fame in Cooperstown. So, welcome to a World Series city. So let's start with Neil.
Okay. Is this on? It's on. Okay. And can you go ahead? So I'm going to motivate my remarks in two ways today. And first of all, I want to say that after 2 years of us all being bombarded by books and media about what really happened in the mortgage meltdown, I want to say that we actually still don't really understand it. And part of the problem coming out of it, I think, is that because of this sort of lack of understanding about exactly what really happened, I think a lot of the sort of traditional ways in which policymakers are trying to deal with the problem are doomed to fail. And I'll come back to this point at the end. Now, if I'm going to make a bold assertion like that, one of the things I want to try to do is, I am going to do something a little bit academic here, is I'm going to walk you through a few tables that I've collected from one of the main sources on the mortgage industry called Inside Mortgage Finance. And these tables will give you a very different view of what the banks were doing than the one that you've seen out there in the media and other kinds of places. And this brings me to my second point. At this point, there's a kind of conventional set of conventional wisdoms, which, like conventional wisdoms always are both a little contradictory and a little incoherent. And let me just give you a couple of them quickly. First of all, that banks did not hold on to mortgage-backed securities, but instead sold them off to the next person, so whoever got at the end of the line ended up being in trouble. This is, it turns out, basically wrong. I have a slide which will show you that. Second of all, that the government caused the crisis by pushing banks to make subprime mortgages. In fact, the government didn't have to encourage banks to make subprime mortgages. As we'll see in one of my slides, the banks wanted, they embraced it, they sought it out with great lust. And finally, that the main cause of what happened was not the banks themselves, but a perfect storm caused by macroeconomic forces. And this account has caused scholars and pundits to focus at the Fed, the SEC, and Chinese bond buyers, and to pay almost no attention to what the banks themselves were doing. And what I'm going to try to do is give you a little flavor of what they were really doing so that you'll maybe have a whole different vision about this. My metaphor here, rather than the perfect storm one, is that what's happened is that if mortgage finance was a barn, that barn is burned down, and the Federal Reserve is now pouring water on it. And as we all know, if you pour water on a barn that's already burned down, it doesn't do you any good. So let me now come back. So to talk about the banks and show you some data. Now, what's my basic theme about what the banks were doing? I think that one of the things that isn't well understood is that all of the largest banks in America were all converging on the activity of mortgage finance. And what happened is that by 2004, commercial banks, mortgage banks, and investment banks were all making their money the same way. They had all created a vertically integrated structure where they were mortgage originators, mortgage packagers, and mortgage servicers, And many of them, of course, were borrowing money to hold on to mortgage-backed securities as investments. And it was this vertical integration of the banks that, at the end of the day, is at the core of what happened in the meltdown. And I'll come back around that in a minute. So let me show you some evidence for that. Let me just begin with a slide which shows the market shares of in mortgages. And what we see is that from the early 1990s, we see an increasing concentration. By the time we get past 2000, and certainly at the end, the top 25 mortgage lenders, both in prime and subprime, are concentrated at about 90% of the market. I'm going to have to get up and... Okay, all right. Now, what is this? Why did this happen? Why did all the banks all of a sudden converge onto the mortgage market? Well, the mortgage market turns out to be quite large and quite attractive. And there was a crisis going on in the mortgage market itself, which you may remember from the savings and loan period. And there was this opportunity for banks to enter into this market and make a lot of money. And all of the banks started moving in this direction, and as they did, they bought up more and more banks, and they bought more and more market share. And I don't think it ever reached the point where it would attract antitrust authorities. In fact, that's not my point today, said it was anti-competitive. But rather, what happened was is that all of the large banks kind of moved in this particular direction. Another way to see this is if we look at the 25 largest financial firms, and then we look at the top 25 firms now in subprime mortgage-backed security markets, what we see from 1998 to 2006 is a kind of convergence. What happened was is that at the beginning of the period, the largest financial firms, and now here I include commercial banks, investment banks, and mortgage banks, were only about a quarter in this business. And by the time you get to the end, it's about, in this one, 56%. Want to give me the next one? Another place where we can see this vertical integration that was going on in the banking industry is in this slide. And what we've done is we've looked at the largest 25 banks again, and we've seen how many segments of the industry that they were in. If you go back, now segments here are, now I realize I'm probably talking about mortgages, which some of you don't know anything about, right? Right, okay, let me say something about that. Origination is, do you actually, in the retail business, do you actually buying and selling mortgages? I'm selling mortgages to people. Issuance refers to the issuance of securities, and underwriting to the underwriting of securities, and servicing to the servicing of securities. Now, almost all mortgages in the United States in this period were turned into securities, mortgage-backed securities, and this meant there were four kind of businesses here. What we see at the beginning is most banks were specialists. But by the time we get to 2006, in fact, the banks have become generalists. They've moved into these other industries with a kind of vengeance. If we take these three slides together, what you begin to see is that the largest banks in the country over this historical period were moving from the businesses they were in, that they were specializing in, to focusing on the mortgage business. And not only just the mortgage business, but all phases of the mortgage business, all right? And this meant that when the crash happened, it didn't just affect part of the banking industry, of the finance industry, it affected all of it. Go on. Now, why were they doing this? Why were they all so excited about this? And I think here's where at least one of the macroeconomic stories comes in, which I think is true. The way that the banks were making money is they were making money off of every part of this business. You made money off of origination, you made money off of securitization, and you made money if you borrowed money at 1% and held onto these bonds which were paying 6 to 8%. And what we see is that as all the banks figured this out, they increased their holdings dramatically in the period 2002 to 2008. And let me talk about this graph for a second. This is the mortgage-related security holdings of the main types of banks in the United States. And I just want to point out some of the lines here that are kind of hard to see probably from the back. We see that Fannie and Freddie are at about a trillion point two. They don't really actually increase their holdings dramatically over this period. However, who does increase their holdings? Investment banks, commercial banks, mutual funds, and foreigners. This is that blue line. Foreigners, in fact, increase their holdings from about $200 billion to about $1.2 trillion. But what we see generally is a kind of increase in this period of how much everybody's holding. So right here, the myth that the banks weren't holding on to the stuff, that's not true. Okay? That's not the way it happened. So in this opportunity that happens, how do we understand what was going on in the market? How do we understand what was actually going on in the market for mortgages in the United States? And this graph is actually one that I think is maybe the most interesting one I have. And let me break it down for you. This looks at all the different types of mortgages that are given out, or mortgage products that are given out in the United States over about a 17-year period. And the most interesting part to look at is the red part. And because the red part are the conventional mortgages. The red part is that 20% down mortgage that's fixed, that's on a kind of 30-year cycle. And what we see here is that up until 2003, conventional mortgages were the vast bulk of the mortgages in the United States. And in 2003, all of a sudden, we see this tremendous drop-off between 2003 and 2004 of conventional mortgages in the United States, and a huge increase of all of the other flavors of mortgage, jumbo, Alt-A, subprime, and home equity loans. We see a substitution in the market for mortgages to people who can afford them, if you like, or people who are buying conventional mortgages, to people who have to pay different kinds of rates that are higher, generally, for their mortgages. What caused that? What caused that great downturn between 2003 and 2004? Something which I don't think has been very much noted by the pundits or the press or anybody except for Alan Greenspan, who in one of his comments understood that this was going on. And I think what happened, and I'll go ahead and tell you because I know, because I've read a lot of the documents from the real estate industry themselves, is that what caused that big spike you see from 2000 to 2003 was a giant wave of refinancing in the United States. And that giant wave of refinancing hit the wall in 2003, and all of a sudden there was no one left to refinance. The banks were now in a position where they had built these vertically integrated structures where they needed mortgage origination, they needed to have stuff they could issue, and they needed to have stuff they could hold, and they had to find some new mortgages. So what did they get the idea of? Well, they got the idea that let's go start loaning money to people who don't have as good a credit. And what we'll do is we'll make more money off of that, and we'll substitute what we had for new forms of mortgages, where we'll have higher returns. And this is what they did. Okay? Can I hit the next one? Now, in answer to the question about did the government make them do it, one of my favorite slides is, this is the, in that other slide, there was one thing I didn't get to. The non-conventional part of the mortgage market was about 30% in 2003. By 2006, it was about 70%. So most of the mortgages being issued in the United States at the end of the bubble were being issued not to prime mortgages, but to subprime and all of those other types, which I'll take questions on later. Who was creating mortgage-backed securities from those mortgages? Well, this is the non-agency means people who weren't Freddie and Fannie. These are the issuances by types. And what we see here is post-2003 that the banks out there were the ones who were issuing the subprime, Alt-A, and second mortgages in the country. So they went into this business with a vengeance. They didn't need the government to tell them to go do it. And in fact, Freddie and Fannie were really not in this business very much at all. This was their choice to do this because the market had turned, and they needed to have these mortgages to continue to make as much money as they were making. Now, let me hit my last slide. So what happened to these people at the end? Well, I just give you a list of the who's who of the walking and dead just to remind you of it. And one of the points of showing you this list is there are lots of points, I guess. One of them is, of course, that the basic core of the American banking system either disappeared, collapsed, or was absorbed into another bank, right? And you all know that at this point. And but I think when you look at a list like this, it kind of blows you away because there's something else going on here, which is that these aren't just savings and loans banks, they're not just mortgage banks, they're not just commercial banks, and they're not just investment banks, they're all of them, right? And that's because, what, as I said to you before, this is how all the banks were making their money. So let me draw a conclusion. Let me just go to conclusions, and I'll is that good? Am I on time?
That's very good. That's excellent.
I'm excellent. Okay. Oh, he's like being excellent. All right. So let me say something. I just want to say one thing about the crash. Since I'm excellent, I'm going to take another minute, and then I am going to go to a conclusion. The sort of cause, and I think John will probably talk to this one, one of the most interesting parts of the crash, and there's been some really interesting work done at the level of the mortgages themselves, is that it wasn't actually that housing prices were going down, it's that they stopped going up. And it was that really precipitates a lot of the kind of stuff that was going on here on the margin, because that's what started to freak everybody out, is that housing prices were, instead of going up like this, they started going up like this, and then that flipped people out, and that's kind of where the thing took a downturn. But maybe John will speak to that point a little bit. It's very interesting, and perhaps we can talk about that. So what's my takeaway? Let me go ahead and get to my takeaway. I would say that my list of the dead, and of course Fannie and Freddie, means at this point that the government owns half the mortgages in the country. And every so often you see an article that says that, but you know, it's kind of one of those matter-of-fact things that people say all the time. But the government does own about half the mortgages in the country. We are at the point now where the only way anybody's getting a mortgage in the country is through those two basket cases that the government owns, Fannie and Freddie, to guarantee those mortgages. There is no mortgage market in America at this point. And I think that what my analysis suggests is why that is. The model that the banks were using, this vertically integrated model, is dead with or without financial reform. As I said, the government owns it. Nobody wants back in there. We're seeing the banks avoiding this business like the plague. Securitization is not going to come back, no matter what, in the kind of way that people would like it to. This whole structure is gone at this point. Now, I think that the bad news is that the mortgage crisis has not run its course. And a huge proportion of mortgages, you see numbers all the time, I don't know if they're true or not, maybe John can speak to that too, are underwater. And in California, of course, we're in as bad a shape as anybody. And worse, thank you, we're in worse shape. And I think the problem for the recovery is another problem that people don't want to talk about, which is that this financial sector, which vertically integrated, which was selling mortgages as quickly as it could to package them to make money in this whole thing, was at its peak generating 40% of the profits in the American economy. That is now gone. That was the growth engine of the American economy. And if I'm right, that growth engine is now burned down, then a lot of what's going on out there in policy circles is, you know, rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic, right? There is no, this isn't going to come back. This is what was causing economic growth in the United States for a good part of the aughts. It's not going to come back. So where is it going to come from, particularly when consumers are underwater and this mortgage thing is sort of drifting along? And if that isn't the most depressing thought, let me give you one more, and that is that, and I know that there's a lot of distinguished economists in the room, and I know most of them are people that I agree with most of the time, but you know, you guys have really seen this as a crisis of macroeconomics, and the tools that are being talked about to be used in this situation are almost all exclusively macroeconomic. And if I'm right about what happened, and I'm right about this big giant crater we've got, then the things you guys are talking about doing is pouring water into that big giant crater. And I think that the policy options out there, just when I read about them at least, don't seem very useful. Thank you.
Yeah.
John is setting up, I want to mention something I should have earlier. Many of you are aware of this, but not all of you. We have a conference website. It's www.early.berkeley.edu/conference/2010. And for now, it's password protected. It's called, the ID is workshop, and the password, I think, is presentation, right? But we'll open it up after we have a chance to clean it up some for the public. And a lot of these materials are presented on the conference website, including the slides.
So I will be brief in setting up some of these issues. On August 1st of 2008, with a great deal of fanfare, the Bush administration introduced the Help for Homeowners program, which was intended to provide assistance in restructuring mortgages to as many as 80,000 households over the next six-month period. At the time the Obama administration was sworn in, there were exactly 831 mortgages which had been modified under that program. So with that as a background, the Obama administration introduced a whole series of programs slowly. The first and largest, the so-called home affordable refinancing program, which was to provide incentives to servicers and to lenders to renegotiate the terms of mortgages, including the write down of principal, but not limited to that, including the extension of the terms of the repayment period or reductions in interest rates. This was followed by the Home Affordable Modification Program for most households. The first one was confined to those who had mortgages that were owned by Freddie and Fannie. The second and more general one was open to all homeowners who were in trouble in some sense, and some of the rhetoric was about medical bills and other things, but it was really unemployment, and that unemployment would qualify one for a renegotiation to reduce payment levels down to less than 31% of income. There was a trial period, and then there was a permanent modification that came afterwards. That was associated with that was a second loan program. If you qualified for this home affordable modification program, the so-called HAMP program, you were eligible for the sweepstakes of trying to renegotiate the terms on second mortgages. Two most recent initiatives have been the so-called hardest hit fund for the six metropolitan or six states with the highest level of foreclosures, and that was funds that were transferred directly to the state governments for their allocation. And the home affordable foreclosure alternatives for people who are already facing foreclosure and how to get out fast with a deed in lieu or perhaps help in negotiating some kind of short sale. The original rhetoric, woo, the original rhetoric that supported these was, oh, that's okay, thanks. The original rhetoric that supported these was that we were going to serve 7 to 9 million homeowners with these programs. You can count here, depending on whether you count trials, you may be up to 2 million or perhaps more if you consider trials as being the first stage of being a participant in the HAMP program. But that doesn't seem to be empirically what's happened. It seems that after 6 months of trials, many people do not qualify for the continued program. So you can see that this program didn't serve quite as many as the administration fondly hoped. This is with a denominator of about 7.6 million households who are in arrears or in foreclosure on their homes in the U.S. So the denominator of this 2 million is about 8 million. I guess the other thing to point out
is that one in six of the modifications that were made under this program are now 60 days past due in payments. So that about one-sixth of these modifications are in some kind of trouble as we speak today. Okay, well, with that as a background, I want to make three points that are more related to the way this market has been working. One is about housing prices, the second is about housing consumption, and the third is about the mortgage market in general, and defer more extended conversation about some of these policies for discussion if people are so inclined. First, let's talk about prices. This shows as of September 30th. Oh, maybe one other point I should make on the slide that I quickly briefed some Obama administration programs. Results of those programs were prominently displayed on the White House website, one click away from a photograph of the president. Until the and it was monthly scorecard that came out, until the monthly scorecard that came out on September 30th. And after that, in order to find these data and how well we were doing, it was two clicks down in the HUD website. Now, I don't know whether that means anything, but it suggests that there are other people who might think that the program is not as successful as they'd want to have on the front page of the White House website. Okay, here's the standard Case-Shiller, September 30th Case-Shiller Weiss home price indexes. These are the first differences, the percentage change over a year ago, the year-over-year changes. And you can see there has been a pullback from the depths of 2009 to a circumstance where the year-over-year changes for the 20-city or the 10-city composite are now over greater than zero. Greater than zero in the sense that there are increases in housing prices in the 10 and the 20 cities until a couple months ago. You can see that little thing hooking down. And all of the stuff that you see on the first page of the business section of the Times is all about that little bit at the end there and whether that's the harbinger of going back down or we're stabilizing and going back up, but it's all about that little bit at the end. If we look at prices themselves, an actual index of house prices, I think one thing that's worth keeping in mind is that if you go over a 40-year period in the U.S., the year-over-year price increases in housing have been quite modest. They've been like 1% real. So if you go back to the 1950s and you draw a line about housing prices, you find that they've been going up 1% real. They've been a great investment for consumers because of the leverage that you get at, not because housing prices have gone through the ceiling, but because the institution is uniquely suited for long-term investment by relatively unsophisticated investors. So people have done quite well in the housing market, but it's not because housing prices have gone up like gangbusters. So you look at this, you know, where we are, and you draw that horizontal line, and it looks like housing prices are about where they were in October of November of 2003. So aggregate house prices now are what they were 7 years ago. Is that a calamity? Is it a disaster? Well, if you're a long-term investor and you've been a long-term investor, it may not be such a disaster. But if you bought in 2004, 2005, 2006, you can see that there is the year-over-year change really makes a big difference. Again, I draw your attention to the very end there. Upturn at the end of 2009, the slight downturn in the beginning of 2010, and the recent upturn, that's all in those last little doodads at the end, and the course of housing prices or the forecast of housing prices that experts produce are largely about changes at this very end. So housing prices have gone down. Housing prices are about what they were 7 years ago. This is a major calamity for some. It's not a major calamity for others. The really unusual thing is this big spike during the early 2000s, right? That's the big deviation from trend, and that's quite a big deal. The second point is about housing construction and housing starts. If you look at housing starts in the U.S. economy on the order of 1 million to 1.2 million on average over a reasonably long period of time, there are rather large fluctuations over time, and there are peaks and troughs in housing starts. Housing construction is quite vulnerable to economic conditions in general. Again, this is investment in durable goods, and there's a big lever on consumption, on income, and the demand for housing. The second thing I would point out to you from this chart is that those little gray areas match up with recessions in the U.S. economy. And if you look, you stare at that, there's only one instance from 1957 until today in which a trough in housing starts was not associated with a recession in the economy. So a good correlate of a lousy economy and an economy that's in real trouble is real big declines in housing starts. And that just comes through from looking at that. The third thing, of course, is to look at the end of that chart. And you'll see that housing starts now are below where they ever were in any time since we've been keeping records in the 1952, I guess. And they're way down. We're talking somewhere less than 500,000 housing starts, and it jiggles around. And we put in a home buyer tax credit, and all of a sudden housing starts to go up for 30 days, and then they go back down, and that's the argument there. So first thing is that housing prices have varied substantially quite recently, and I leave it for you to interpret whether this is a lot of variation or a little variation. Second thing is that the macro economy does it's highly correlated, let us say, with housing starts in the economy, and when we find housing starts are way down, we also find that that the economy is likely to be in trouble on other grounds. Third thing is on issues of the mortgage market. This is just a graph of delinquency rates going up through 2010, is the most recent data that are available. You'll notice all loans have increased from 1986 to 2008 and then went up substantially in 2008. Prime loans went up as well, but they went up from a substantially smaller base. But just look at those option arms, eh? Option arm is where you could sign the contract and you could either make a payment or not make a payment and add to your principal. Because you could refinance in a couple of years anyway, and so it was an effective use of your resources. Just look at the default rates. These are total past due. Okay, that's only 30 days. Here's the scary one. That's the delinquency rates, 90 days past due on various kinds of mortgages. You'll see an upturn in 2008, 2009. The upturn in 2008 is well after the so-called the period in which loans issued in 2005 and 2006 would hit resets. So we're beyond, for the most part, the reset problem, if you will, associated with exotic mortgages that were issued in the early and mid 2000s, the early and mid part of the century, and we're really looking at other reasons why these delinquency rates have increased substantially. And I guess you can probably guess what that is. Finally, I will leave one other, and that is the extent to which sales of houses, current sales of houses, are mixtures of houses that are newly built or used houses that are transacted, and houses that are distressed in one way or another. The percentage of total transactions that are short sale sanctioned by banks to get out from under mortgages and to allow the holder of the mortgage to leave free and clear, or else they're REO sales, sales of properties that were taken over by the banks and are now being offered to consumers. You put all these three things together and you see there's immediately a kind of reason why new construction is at relatively low levels. There's all this stuff around that can be purchased and that is being offered for sale, and lots of the sales are of this stock, and that reduces the demand for the need for new construction, which I guess is the pessimistic note on which I would leave this conversation. One other question I might raise in all of this is, why are we spending all of this? If the problem is one of not enough demand for housing, it's not so obvious that we want to take a lot of steps to increase the price of housing or to support the price of housing in an economy like this. But recognizing that if we don't support the price of housing in an economy like this, we are not going to have a positive effect upon new construction. So there's a bit of a dilemma here. And if you believe that given the course of the economy and the fact that one out of eight breadwinners is out of work, the demand for housing is clearly soft, and that might generally result in a lower price of housing that would clear this market. There are lots of individuals and institutional groups that claim that that's the wrong thing to do. I'll leave it at that.
Thank you. You've also got an excellent for your timing. All right. Doug is next.
Thank you. I don't have any slides. I have a text, though, because I'm an anxiety neurotic, so I need to clutch to it. We all know, by the way, I should, a little note of self-promotion. I'm doing my radio show from the KPFA studios around the corner tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock, 94.1. I'm going to interview Michael Hudson, who has a new book, The Journalist, not The Economist, called The Monster, about how the subprime thing happened, and also David K. Johnston on how the rich have been really raking it in, which is hardly a new topic for anybody, especially David K. Johnston. We all know the story of the proximate causes of the housing crisis, a massive housing bubble enabled by massive applications of credit, but not merely that, but credit packaged into unimaginably complex and obscure forms, and the dispersion of responsibility that came with securitization. There was a synergy of troublemaking here. Mortgage debt, after rising gently through the 80s and 90s, exploded after 2000, rising from about 60% of after-tax income to a peak of 100%. In 2007. We know that lending standards deteriorated to where the only requirement for getting a loan was having a pulse, and I'm sure you could even find some exceptions to that rule. Down payments became optional. The habit of packaging mortgages into bonds and selling them to distant investors removed a lot of incentive for the originating lender to scrutinize the creditworthiness of the borrowers, and that allowed trouble to proliferate around the world when things went sour. My use of the word bond there is actually almost as quaint as a down payment, because the finest minds of Wall Street assembled all manner of complex derivatives that no one, even some of the people who sold them, could understand. And maybe no one is an exaggeration, but I think only several hundred people in the world could actually understand a lot of these derivatives. Investors had no idea what horrors were hidden in the structured products that they bought, even though many came with AAA ratings, because either the rating agencies didn't know what they were doing or didn't care. The issuers of the dodgy securities were the ones who were paying the fees, and as one rater put it in a famous email, they would rate things assembled by cows. Of course, they weren't put together by cows. They were put together by investment bankers, who are a far more dangerous lot. Now, all this is true, but it's a mistake to look at only that part of the story. Today's crisis also has a prehistory going back to the problems of the 1970s and the neoliberal prescription for fixing those problems. The problem of the 1970s was, of course, stagflation. The stag part, stagnation, is actually a little misleading. The expansion of the Carter years saw job growth four times as rapid as that we saw the Bush, George W. Bush expansion, and GDP growth half again as high. For the whole decade of the 1970s, GDP growth was half again as high as it was in the most recent decade. But such a comparison for employment is impossible because job growth in this decade is actually slightly negative, the only 10-year period in U.S. history for which you can say such a thing. The gap between job and GDP growth, and comparing the 70s and the 2000s, is striking and gives a hint of the contrasting class dynamics of the two eras. By the way, the recovery so far, such as it is even more strikingly class imbalanced, with profits up about 50% over the last year and wage and salary income up just 1%. A 3-to-1 ratio is average the first year of a recovery. A 50-to-1 ratio is unprecedented and rather scandalous. But the inflation part of the 1970s was important. The CPI maxed out at nearly 15% in 1980 and hit 18% in 1 month at an annualized rate in March of 1980. Wartime inflations were common in U.S. history, but we'd never seen anything like this chronic and deteriorating performance in the price sphere. But inflation wasn't just about prices. It was also about sagging productivity, falling profitability, limp financial markets, and less quantifiably, a general loss of discipline in the workplace and the erosion of American power in the world. Corporate profitability, which peaked at about 11% in return on tangible assets in 1966, fell by two-thirds to under 4% return in 1980. With high inflation, holding bonds became a losing proposition. Treasury bonds were nicknamed certificates of confiscation in the 70s. Stocks turned in one of their worst decades ever. Not as bad as the 1930s, but close, and that's in a history that goes back to the 1840s. But it wasn't just a matter of numerical indicators. The U.S. had lost the Vietnam War, and oil and other commodity exporters were jacking up prices, and even the third world on a whole was demanding redistribution on a global scale. Though it's largely forgotten now, the working class was restive and rebellious. Formal strikes were common in the 1970s. Of course, they were in the 50s and 60s. They've since virtually disappeared. But so were the wildcat kind. People forget that back in 1970, Richard Nixon called out the National Guard to deliver the mail because the postal workers were on a self-organized strike. At that point, they had no union. The strike prompted the reorganization of the Postal Service, and shocking to someone looking back to this in 2010, legislation authorized postal workers to form unions and bargain collectively. Later in the decade, we heard a lot about the blue-collar blues, and in 1978, the appropriately named country singer Johnny Paycheck scored a hit with the song Take This Job and Shove It. Obviously, something had to give, and what gave was the working class, domestically and internationally. Paul Volcker came into office declaring in October 1979 that the American standard of living had to decline, and he promptly made it happen by driving up interest rates towards 20% and creating the deepest recession since the 1930s. We've just beat that record, but it took us 30 years. To this one-sided class war, Reagan added the ammunition of firing the air traffic controllers, the very opposite of what a Republican president had done with the striking postal workers just a decade earlier, and it was open season on organized labor. Wages and social spending were squeezed, and the deregulatory agenda that began under Carter was intensified. Abroad, Latin America was thrown into a debt crisis, a crisis that for a while threatened to take down the global banking system, but instead the problem was solved through the now familiar neoliberal agenda of privatization and opening up to cross-border trade and financial flows. The program was very successful. The recession scared the hell out of the American working class. People were glad to have a job and wouldn't dream of singing about telling anyone to shove it. Profitability recovered strongly, rising throughout the 1980s and 90s to a peak of 8% in 1997. That wasn't quite back to 1966 levels, but it was still more than twice the trough of 15 years earlier. It took a while, but productivity finally joined in the upsurge, rising rapidly throughout the late 90s and into the next decade. In the military political sphere, U.S. power was enhanced, and we kicked the Vietnam syndrome along the way, too. Discipline problems were a thing of the past. There were a few interruptions, a stock market crash in 1987 that looked scary for a while, and a long stagnation and jobless recovery in the early 90s, and then there was the bursting of the dot-com bubble a decade later. But all in all, the system managed to recover from, even thrive, it seemed, on all its troubles, and the state managers perfected all their bailout techniques. Of course, each bailout laid the groundwork for the next bubble, but Alan Greenspan said famously that One needn't worry about bubbles because one can always clean up after them when they burst. He has lately seemed somewhat chastened on that topic. But through these bubbles, busts, and recoveries, one constant persisted. A system dependent on high levels of mass consumption has a hard time living with a prolonged wage squeeze. I mean that not only in the economic sense, but also in a political and cultural one. American life can be very insecure and volatile, and the ability to buy lots of gadgets assuages that to a considerable degree. Mass consumption staves off what could be a serious legitimation crisis. For the last few decades, the economic and political contradiction has been managed, if not resolved, not that could ever be fully resolved, through the liberal use of debt. First it was credit cards, and then mortgages from the mid-1990s onward. The explosion of household credit from about 65% of disposable income in 1983 to 135% of disposable income at the 2007 peak, most of that increase coming from mortgages, by the way, is what made the booms and bubbles of the last three decades possible. This is especially true of the 2001-2007 expansion, which featured the slowest employment and aggregate wage growth of any cycle since the numbers began in 1929. Without the massive cashing in on appreciating home equity, Americans withdrew several $1 trillion worth of home equity during the decade of boom and spent a lot of it, consumption would have languished and the home improvement business would have essentially gone under. And since we have almost no domestic savings, most of the cash for that adventure came from abroad, from places like the People's Bank of China. But it seems impossible to go back to that old model of doing an economy now that it's burst, although we haven't quite shaken the borrowing abroad habit. The housing market is still busted, as are the consumer credit markets. Retail spending has picked up from the depths of 2008-2009, but it's not likely that we're going to go back to the old pace of spending anytime soon. There's an interesting class point under the retail sales numbers. The pickup in retail sales over the last year or so has been led by the so-called luxury sector, with discounters in second place. That is, the upper orders are doing pretty well, and everyone else has been trading down. And the middle is looking rather hollow. And despite being flush with cash, corporations today are not investing or hiring. The job market is very weak, and a minor revival in capital spending now looks to be petering out. So what's next? While the encouragement of clean energy and other green technologies would seem to hold great promise for generating fresh growth over the longer term, the political and financial system seem incapable of getting there. Our ruling class, such as it is, seems to have lost the capacity to think beyond the next quarter. New Jersey's thuggish new governor, Chris Christie, has just canceled his state's participation in a rail tunnel under the Hudson, a project that would not only create lots of jobs in the immediate present, but would have had long-term productivity payoffs. But Christie says the state can't afford it. He's not alone in this kind of thinking. A number of Republicans candidates are running against the modest high-speed rail project funded by last year's stimulus bill. I don't think it's only just a budgetary thing. I suspect that they also think that trains are for pansies and real men get around in Escalades. It's a historical fact that many major industries in the U.S. got their start through public subsidies, from the railroads in the 19th century through the computer and pharmaceutical industries in the 20th century. There would be no internet without the Pentagon. But today's political elite will hear little of this. There was a $5 billion fund for clean energy research in the STIMPAC, but it was raided to fund the Cash for Clunkers program, a program with little economic and even less environmental payoff. My good friend Christian Parenti has written about how even something as mundane as a concerted public procurement program, the federal government buying lots of clean vehicles and such, could make a major difference in kickstarting a new industrial revolution. But efforts along those lines so far have been rather feeble, even though they'd be pretty easy to accomplish. Meanwhile, the Chinese have been building high-speed rail like crazy and are surging forward in solar and other green technologies. In a piece in the Chinese rail effort a few weeks ago, the Financial Times led with a vignette of Arnold Schwarzenegger shopping for equipment in Shanghai, as the paper put it, looking for trains, technology, and funding for the planned high-speed upgrade to his state's rail network, much of which was built in the 19th century by Chinese laborers. The Chinese rail sector, it's worth pointing out, is dominated by state-owned firms. I was in a crazy TV debate with a Tea Party stockbroker type recently, who was talking up how China is now more capitalist than we are. I don't want to say that China's state-heavy system is socialist exactly, but it is a lot more effective than our haphazard nonsense has proved to be lately. But as I said earlier, our ruling class doesn't want to think that way. And to be honest, right now they have no incentive to. In my catalog of our economic woes, I forgot to emphasize the fact that the bourgeoisie hardly seems to be suffering. At least until recently, productivity has been rising nicely. Not because of a rise in high-tech investment or any kind of technological innovation, as it was in the late 1990s, but because employers are working their employees harder and paying them less. That delivers a nice fattening of profits, although you have to wonder how long that sort of thing can play out. A friend who works for a hedge fund told me just the other day that 9% unemployment looks to be good for the stock market. Stay long capital, he spelled it with a K, and you should be okay, he advised. Of course, not all of us, those with only our labor power to sell, can stay long capital with a C or a K. But as you may have noticed, this is not France. The unemployed do not burn cars, the already employed do not fight austerity, and high school students do not go on strike to defend old age pensions and stage enchanting kiss-ins in the process. You can draw lots of parallels between our recent bubble and the Gilded Age of the 19th century, but at least our first Gilded Age was spiced up by troublesome rural populists and urban socialists. Michael Reich asked me to conclude this with some questions that could serve as topics for discussion and future research. I'm happy to present these questions since I don't really have any good answers for them. First, am I missing something in seeing little prospect for serious economic recovery? I've long lamented the left habit of seeing no way out of a future of endless stagnation. Capitalism is a very resourceful thing, and to paraphrase G.P. Morgan, it's long been a mistake to sell short the United States of America. Mainstream types love to point to our wondrous flexibility, a nicer way of describing what I earlier characterized as volatility and insecurity, and also love to celebrate our immense capacities for innovation. But as the U.S. cuts back on R&D spending and public investment, and it gets more and more hostile to immigrants, is our time as a great innovator running out? Even the venture capitalists of Sand Hill Road are starting to look more to Asia than to their own backyard. But it was also common to proclaim the end of the American century back in the 1970s, and now that looks premature in retrospect. Is there some embryo hiding somewhere that will develop into something dynamic, or have we, as George Soros almost said a few years ago before the Council on Foreign Relations before stopping himself, have we shot our wad? And what about our ruling class? I said a little while ago that it looks incapable of thinking beyond the next quarter. I've been thinking about writing a book on the ruling class, some sort of hybrid of C. Wright Mills and Vanity Fair, but I set it aside for some personal reasons. But I'd like to turn back to it soon. My working hypothesis was that nothing coherent has replaced the old Northeastern WASP elite as a ruling stratum. Though that was often greedy and brutal in itself, and it had a disdain for commerce and an ethic of stewardship that helped it plan, for example, the post-World War II order with some degree of actual vision and skill. Its members all went to the same schools, belonged to the same clubs, and married from the same small and homogeneous pool. But now, to use the jargon of Wall Street, the transaction has replaced the relationship. It's all about who can make the most money most quickly, and the long term can hang itself. Can a complex and hierarchical society like ours really be run by such a depraved social formation? Can the U.S. elite reconstitute itself as it has several times in the past? For a while, I thought Obama might represent some sort of rationalization of the system, some effort of repair after the decadence of the Bush years, but it's not turning out that way. Neither he nor his paymaster seem interested in or capable of such a project. That's another view of our economic problem. I don't think an elite can stay rich and powerful forever while their society's foundations rot underneath it. But am I right in this? Or can the oligarchy barrel ahead while everything around them goes to hell? I hope there's someone out there who can answer these questions for us. Thanks.
Thank you, Doug. I should have mentioned that Doug has a book called Wall Street, but I don't think that's the one that got made into a movie, right? That's a
prequel.
All right, that's a prequel. All right, Rob is next.
Well, thank you for inviting me to join you here today and to participate in your conference.
I start with a note that I got from my daughter last night. I published my calendar electronically, and she looked at the entry, and she said, "Dad, you're going on a game show." I wrote back and said, "What?" She said, "Well, you know, deal, no deal. Isn't that the game show?" Or the program? So hopefully it's a step up from that. I was relieved when I got here, and I didn't see people holding up the big carts. I do not have either a PowerPoint or a neurotic note sheet. So I thought I would begin by quoting Bob Dylan, who said, "I embrace chaos. I wonder if it embraces me." And when I looked up that quote this morning, I thought it had come from a Nate Hanoff interview in 1966, but I understand it was first said in an interview to Ralph Gleason in Berkeley, California, in December of 1965. What I'm going to talk about today is the relationship of the United States and its international role to the challenge of trust and how financial reform affects the ability of our society to respond to these challenges. I believe the challenges are structural, not cyclical, and I think they're very, very formidable. To start a little bit with where Doug left off with the ruling class, recently, and you should see this, it's in video on the web, Zbigniew Brzezinski gave a speech at the Council on Foreign Relations. And he said, in essence, the white guy model across the North Atlantic has broken down. We can all call it the G20, and the elite have no plan that they can all agree to restore order. He then said, in the aftermath of the financial crisis and the bailouts, we have awakened and agitated the populations of the world, and they're more sensitive to politics than they've ever been. I'm also reminded that Samuel Huntington's last essay before he died was about Davos Man and how young American elites had become, unbound to any allegiance to the United States at the center of the world system, and why he thought that that was quite a dangerous development. Where I'll start the story is that the United States is, as you all know, the reserve currency of the world. And we've had a system for years, particularly after the Asian crisis, where peripheral economies or developing economies, they're now very large, engaged in building up reserves, essentially a self-insurance war chest, or alternatively to protect their export-led growth, maintain a lower exchange rate. And those monies were redeposited in the dollar. The result of that was that the Federal Reserve, with its mandate of full employment and price stability, was always receiving kind of a transaction structure that tended to push up the dollar and push down interest rates. That process could be managed. The Fed could cut interest rates. The interest-sensitive sectors, as we saw in the presentations on housing and consumer durables, took off, and we ran a very large current account imbalance at the same time. There was essentially a trade-off between interest rates and exchange rates that favored a stronger exchange rate and lower interest rate constellation. The problem with that now is that we're at the zero lower bound. So in a world that's unstable, and the paper I sent to your website is called The Paradox of Risk Aversion, as everybody becomes afraid that we're in a period of what people call Knightian uncertainty, in other words, structure is not well known, it's not like a deck of cards, it's like sailing in the fog, we're in a place where people accumulate reserves, they put them in the dollar, the Fed's already at zero, that sends a deflationary shock to the United States, and the natural response would be an expansion of fiscal policy. But as we approach this election and it looks as if the Democratic Party will lose significantly, that response comes into question, and on the other side of that response is potential deflation. I'm not amused, but I am curious as I watch the arguments about fiscal policy, and you see what I will call the advanced troops on the right with very, very large underemployment acting as if fiscal policy doesn't work. The argument takes a technical form of people talking about the various size of multipliers. And I see that argument and people with scientific and technical training doing their best. But what's problematic is I don't think that is what the argument's about. I think the people on the right are willing to take a depression right now to purge society's structure of a large role for government that was put in place during the New Deal. And they're happy to fight with you on the sidebar about fiscal expansion working or not working, but they don't really care. This problem of trust and even the capacity to use fiscal policy it was violently exacerbated by the financial reform process. And in essence, what I'm really saying today is that free market fundamentalism has failed, confidence or romance about the government has failed, and confidence and expertise has failed, and we are in a position as a society where we have to create a new, what you might call, civic equilibrium. I've seen a lot of self-congratulation in the government about TARP because and their narrow measures of getting 8% of their money back and so forth. But I think that the nature of the bailout, I'll quote a Amartya Sen, who gave a very nice presentation in an economic history seminar I was at Harvard, where he said, yes, it was like a cooperative game. By not letting the real economy go down with the financial sector, we lost less than we otherwise would have. But what people didn't understand, either in the Paulson Treasury or in the Obama administration's Treasury, is that there are ways and there are ways. And what we essentially did was we had those who were polluted paying the polluters. The financial sector was paid and rescued and then absolutely inflamed the American people when they paid themselves bonuses in January of 2010, just at the time of the Massachusetts election. When one looks at polls, and the best one to give you the current state, I think, is the July 31st poll of the Pew Foundation, what you find is the American people, and it is not Democrats, it is not Republicans, and independents do not differ particularly. They believe that what happened was large corporations and big financial institutions were bailed out, and the middle class and the poor didn't get much benefit. As it was put to me in a conversation I had with some of the people at Pew just about a week ago, they said, the American people think they're choosing between shutting off the faucet on subsidies to the wealthy and powerful and keeping the faucet open and putting a tax burden on their children's shoulders to support the wealthy and the powerful. They don't see the trade-off in other terms. Now, that may or may not be true, but it's certainly, and in the paper I sent you, I bring out two tables. It looks to me as though what Sen said, which is the repeated game of governance, has suffered a great deal from the inference drawn from that cooperative game, that, how I say, win, lose less approach to the bailouts, where AIG's bailout included payoff of 100 cents on the dollar and other things. The way the guy at Pew put it to me in the conversation is he said, Rob, it's like we're all in a golf club, and we all pay dues, but only the rich guys get to play the course. When I look at this, I see the Obama administration in great trouble because the problem is that they didn't, in marketing terms, differentiate themselves from their predecessors. And it is really quite unfortunate, given the amount of capital that brilliant young man on the campaign trail created and enlisted the support of young people who are now having very difficult times getting jobs, and basically people throughout the country wanted transformation and change. What I believe Obama needed to do was hold a ritual of sacrifice, whether it be top managements, creditors of banks, or a restructuring of a large, complex financial institution, and he didn't do any of those things. When you look at historical precedence for this, I'm very attracted to the writings of Harold James, his new book, The Creation and Destruction of Value, and his earlier book on the German slump, focus on the 1931 crisis in Germany and the loss of trust that took place at that time. And in his new book, the first title I mentioned, he talks about the parallels between 2008 and 1931. And it's about the capacity to govern in the absence of trust. When I look at the Dodd-Frank bill, I would see it very simply as a bill that was in large part an act of forbearance. Rather than putting in place hard and fast rules, rather than taking away the power from the Federal Reserve, which did not use the powers it had in preventing this crisis, they have given the Fed the opportunity, if they deem it valuable and necessary ultimately, after a period of study and forbearance, to do things like separate proprietary trading from the other activities of the institution, or remove the swaps desk and other derivatives. And I think in this realm of too big to fail, the interwoven nature of over-the-counter derivatives with too big to fail balance sheets creates a subsidy structure that leads to a massive overuse of OTC derivatives and also an intertwined nature between large complex financial institutions that makes them nearly impossible to resolve. When you look at the Dodd-Frank bill, they made the claim that with the resolution powers, which I think was a helpful dimension, that we would achieve the end of too big to fail. Most large complex financial institutions are global in nature. Most of those institutions, we do not have a roadmap of regulatory jurisdictions. We do not have a roadmap of international exposures. We do not have a cross-border regime of bankruptcy harmonization so creditors could be penalized, given what they call write-down haircuts on an equal basis across domains. And financiers are very smart. If they know that a certain jurisdiction has different laws that makes it harder for bankruptcy, that's where they issue their debt. And that's where the creditors go to give them the debt, because you pay a lower interest rate when there's no fear of default risk. That leads to subsidizing these too-big-to-fail institutions on an ongoing basis, and that leads to either too much leverage or stealing of market share from smaller institutions, and we have a very, very distorted capital market as a result. I don't think this bank bill got at it. The other dimensions which we're not dealing with, which others talked about today, is we are not doing very much on foreclosure, and we are still tolerating usurious levels of interest rates. The Republican strategy as the bill was coming forward, led by Richard Shelby, was essentially to weaken the bill and collect campaign contributions. And at the end of the game, either the bill was extremely weak and the Republicans would vote against it, the Democrats would vote for it, and the Democrats would say, and the Republicans would say, see, the Democrats are owned by Wall Street, this bill's weak. Or alternatively, the bill could get so weak that the Democrats would not vote for it themselves, and the Republicans would say, these people hold 59 seats in the Senate. They control the House. They own the White House, and they can't even govern. They must be owned by Wall Street. They had a very, very bad situation, and as I say, I think this was the scenario or the context in which trust evaporated or markedly diminished, and I would send you to the Gallup polls, which disaggregate by government institution every 6 months on the public approval of those institutions. Between 2004 and the present, the Federal Reserve has fallen by 33%, and this year in the June report, which was data collected in April, they were less popular than the IRS in the month of tax collection. To kind of finish up, I guess I'll go back to Bob Dylan, and the quote is from the first line of All Along the Watchtower, there must be some way out of here. I think the deeper structural problems really relate to the contradiction between the World War II model of the United States as the buyer of last resort, and everybody else structuring their society, their parliaments, their taxes, and everything around export-led growth to the United States, and the contradiction that was set in motion by the globalization particularly of unskilled labor, from NAFTA and more accelerating as China development took place. The way in which we dealt with that contradiction, as other speakers today have talked about, is by relying on the anesthetic of consumer finance. If your income wasn't rising very much, your living standard could continue for a time, as long as you could get greater and greater credit to support a given level of income. So the way out of here, well, I thought I got a glimpse of it last night as I watched Elizabeth Warren give the Mario Savio lecture here. And she conveyed a strong empathy for the people who were suffering. She dares people on the other side to suggest that the middle class dream is not what Americans should be striving for. She relishes the fight, and she shows a level of defiance where she said, yes, I'm the interim director of the new Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, and they may remove me tomorrow, but between tonight and tomorrow, I'm going to work as hard as I can to make this thing better and stronger, and I have no other choice. I can't live with myself. I have no other choice unless I do that. And what I would say is that in this period, when so many elites, like Doug referred to, are standing on the deck of the Titanic, and they're looking out at the iceberg, and they look at the navigator, and they look at the skipper, and they look at each other, and they try to figure out whether to get the food and the jewels into their lifeboat or try to help this steer things away from the ice, what I would say is that we cannot afford, now that trust has been shattered, not to embrace this chaos and to take some risks as individuals and as experts to repair the system together. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for everyone on the panel for terrific talks, which I think are going to stimulate very good discussion. We are running a little late, mainly because I took so much time at the beginning. And so I'm going to forego a little presentation I had put together on how economies historically have gotten out of crisis and structural crises, and save that maybe if I can get some time in the evening session instead. But I will do a little plug, which is I got a new book out called Contemporary Capitalism and Its Crises, which there's also a copy at the front, which goes into this discussion. It's called The Social Structure of Accumulation Theory for the 21st Century, something I've been working on since the 1970s, since come out in various forms since then. There are a couple of questions that I see that might structure our discussion a little bit. Here's what occurs to me, and then I'll open the floor. Don't feel you have to be constrained by these, but at least maybe it'll create some structure. The first is, especially from the first two talks, but also the second two, we've gotten a sense of the economy in much more serious, having much more serious problems than I think people foresaw in late 2007 or even a year later. And this has since been called, oh, well, it's a financial crisis, and we should have known that financial crises always are protracted and take a long time to recover. Same famous thesis now of Rogoff and Reinhardt, who, though, never look at any political variables and try to explain why the financial crises are hard to get out of. But I think it's still a question, especially for economists, why was the downturn as deep as it was and the recovery more protracted? Is it just these problems in the housing market? Is it the underlying problems that Doug referred to about wage stagnation, consumption, lack of consumption demand, or is it our inability to reform because we have such a decline in trust, as for the reasons that Rob was suggesting? I think it's also that there's some internal crisis within finance. This is an extremely unusual financial crisis where people didn't know what the instruments were worth afterwards. There's a lot of panic. And yes, the banks didn't have to sacrifice a dollar, you know, or any pennies on the dollar. But it feels to me that a lot of the problems in the banks, not just talking about the homeowners and their mortgages, but the banks themselves have not unwound their problems. I read recently that, for example, Lehman Brothers, which we all know failed, you know, was allowed to fail in September, what was it, 15 of 2008. I've read that only one third of all their trades have been unwound in the time since. So there's a lot of people still on hold, and so you can imagine that is going on within the major banks still as well. Second question. Well, I'm not saying that is the answer, but it is a question, I think. Why did the credit or financial crisis lead to such a downturn, and will it go on for a long time? What do we need to generate recovery is another question that's come up. I think Doug would agree with, say, the idea, well, it's going to take some increase in living standards, create consumer demand. Otherwise, we won't have a leading sector. Since it's a global recession, it's very hard to grow in exports, and to me, at least, investments most of the time respond to what's happening in the consumer market rather than are a source of recovery itself, unless there's some new technological innovations or new markets have opened up. So, is there a way to raise living standards? That, you know, because that would is that possible in this period? The third question is, why is it that only the banks were bailed out and not, say, the public pension funds, which also have a crisis, or homeowners? That's obviously raises the question of vested interests and the kinds of political power problems that Simon Johnson, right, of MIT has been raising quite a bit. And another question comes out of the discussion is, why is the elite or the bourgeoisie or the ruling class, whatever you want to call them, so disorganized? I actually thought that the problem of global coordination a couple of years ago when we were working on this book were so serious that there was no way to resolve them. But I was very surprised, say, a year and a half ago, in the summer of 2009, I guess, every country in the world, major economy in the world, had decided on a stimulus program and was putting one into place. That's an extraordinary amount of coordination, or, you know, at least coordinated and simultaneous action. Even Angela Merkel in Germany, who was saying, no, we don't do those sorts of things, was actually doing it, and even more than the United States was. A year later, every elite country, except maybe the U.S., or the elites in every country, are saying, oh, no, we can't do any more stimulus. We have to shut things down more, in a way that, of course, is going to be counterproductive. And so why did that happen? I mean, to me, it's really it's a big surprise, and it indicates a degree of disorganization or the role of ideology or something maybe that suggests that free market fundamentalism isn't quite as dead as we'd like it to be. I think might be one answer. Or it could be Rob's answer, well, we just want to push back, we being the elites, especially on public sector union power, in both in the U.S. but also in Europe as well. And anyhow, that's a set of questions, and please feel free to comment on them or on what the panelists have discussed or say your own two cents. All right. Dean, yeah. Just say who you are also when you talk.
Dean Baker.
And I think somewhere there's a microphone that's going around. Where's the mic? Anyone? Go ahead. There we go.
Hey, a lot of ground covered here. And just to say a couple quick things. First off, I mean, I'm surprised people are surprised at the severity of the downturn. I'm a big fan of national income accounting. Maybe it's the only thing I ever learned in economics. But, you know, you go, okay, well, what happened as a result of the bubbles? Well, we lost somewhere in the order of $600 billion a year in construction demand, residential and non-residential. I don't see how anyone could expect that to come back. We have huge overbuilding in real estate. Vacancy rates are record high. You look at non-residential, same thing. You look at, you know, whether it's retail space, office space, no one in their right mind is going to start a new project now. So we've lost $600 billion in demand in the construction sector. On top of that, we've lost, my calculation, on the order of $6 trillion in housing bubble wealth, and we're probably going to lose another $2 trillion. I mean, my expectation is it's going to fall a lot more now that the effects of the credit are over, but just stop there. And plus the stock market well. So we've lost on the order of $600 billion in annual consumption. This is a wealth effect. I mean, this isn't, I say this with people, and they're looking at me like it's some crazy radical thing. It was one of the first things I learned in economics. I mean, people spend based on their wealth, right? Wealth's disappeared. They're spending less. The savings rate in the most recent data was 5.5%. That's well below the historic average. When people say, how come people aren't spending? I say, how come they're not saving more? You know, everyone wants to, in Washington wants to cut their Social Security. So I don't really understand the mystery here. We've lost $1.2 trillion in annual demand. What do we think will make that up? And but to be the optimist here, you know, I I don't see how we got in this as being a great mystery either, because, you know, my big demons and I, they rise higher in my level of demonness by the day, the IMF. If you go back to 1997, we really did have a change in our dynamic. Our trade deficits, our huge trade deficits, could really be dated to 97 and the East Asian financial crisis, because the basic story there was that the countries of the region went into a, you know, a financial crisis. The IMF came in, posed very harsh conditions, said you're going to have to pay off your debt, you'll export like crazy. And what happened was their currencies fell through the floor. Lessons those countries and every other country in the developing world took away from that is you have to build up huge reserves as an insurance policy. The only way you do that is by exporting like crazy and devaluing your currency. Look at our trade pattern since 1997 as compared to pre-97. And again, getting back to my favorite topic, national income accounting, if you have a huge trade deficit, you have to have negative national savings, which means either very large budget deficits or very low private sector savings or some combination thereof. So I don't see any great mysteries here. How you get out of that, obviously, it's a political issue. We have to get the dollar down. We have to get something closer to balanced trade. Again, back when I was taking economics, rich countries like the United States were supposed to be net exporters of capital, not importers. But that seems to make sense to me. So I don't really see a lot here that's terribly controversial in terms of the economics. How you get through it politically, of course, is going to be very, very complicated.
Thank you, Dean. Okay. Someone else? Say who you are.
Hi, I'm Harvey Smith with the National New Deal Preservation Association. The one word I didn't hear this morning was deregulation, and I'm just wondering, you know, what role you all think that that played in this. And also, although I think Doug and others might have alluded to this, the income gap we're dealing with. You know, we've got the biggest gap in income since the late 20s. So obviously, you know, and that relates to, you know, not stagnation in wages, but wages are actually less than they were in previous times. So that obviously has an impact on all this. So, you know, you could look at housing, but you could also look at ways to put people to work and building up other infrastructure so that people have money in their pocket and you're actually have got a Main Street program. So I think we're dealing with elites, yeah, the top 1% that only think about the, you know, the next quarter. But I think there's got to be ways that we can, you know, put people to work. And if we're, you know, if we're comparing what's going on today with the New Deal, obviously the New Deal had a lot of lessons, leaves us with a lot of lessons, including bailing out, you know, people with their mortgages and putting people to work. So okay. Any comments?
Thank you, Harvey. I think we're going to do is just take a set of comments or questions from the floor to give you guys more chances to talk, and we'll save some time toward the end for everyone on the panel to respond.
Just a couple of, Fred Block, just a couple of comments, not getting at the kind of core question of how do we get out of this. That I was surprised that in the discussion of the mortgages and the subprime issue, and Neil did a good job of showing its centrality, that there wasn't really a mention of race. And that, you know, at the heart of this was essentially a project of racial appropriation, because the bulk of the subprime loans went into minority communities that in the period leading up to that shift, the shift in 2003 that he talks about, it had been marginal figures who were engaged in predation, who were doing the predatory lending in poor communities. And essentially, at that turning point, the predation went mainstream and these big financial institutions became involved. And the important thing there is that a lot of this was people going door to door in minority communities where people already owned their homes, had mortgages already, and said, you want to sign this piece of paper, you'll get $50,000, you know, cash up front, or $30,000 or whatever. And the fine print was that they were buying into a subprime loan, which would reset and so forth. So the amount of actual theft, you know, that when at the core of this crisis, it seems to me, has been understated. The second point I was going to make is that I think Rob is right in terms of pointing to the kind of crisis of governance, crisis of confidence. But I get a little bit uneasy in terms of the blaming Obama. Had he been presented himself in a somewhat different way in 2009, 2010, done the financial rescue, but did it in a somewhat different way, that we wouldn't be in the same position that we're in now. And I think that there's essentially a problem with that, because almost always those arguments is that if he had been a little bit more left, a little bit more populist, a little bit more focusing on the big structures, then everything would have been fine. But the reality is that the reaction would have set in. The Tea Party, the right, they were already geared up. That counter-mobilization was going to take place. And if anything, had he been more radical, more forthright in terms of the structural measures, I suspect that the response would have been very similar, that we would be in exactly the same boat that we're in today.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm Cynthia Kroll. I'm at the Fisher Center for Real Estate. I guess I had one comment and a couple of comments. The first was, I think it's misleading to present this as being all about the banks when, you know, if you said this is all about the financial sector and what happened there, I wouldn't have a problem with that. But I think it's really important to distinguish between what happened in the banks, what happened in the investment banks, and what happened in these other totally unregulated portions of the mortgage industry. Because I think that's, you know, where a big part of the lesson is for what should be happening going forward. This conference is called the New Deal. So I'd like to think about, have we learned any, a question I think is important is, have we learned anything for housing policy? And what really should be the direction of housing going forward? Can it be used to help stimulate the employment growth sectors going forward, or is it completely dead as a possibility? Are there options or possibilities for linking housing with other types of environmental energy issues to try and build at least within that part of the sector and direct new investment to that as a way of working out of this recession. So I guess I have to say I prepared for this session by going and seeing Inside Job last night. It's horribly depressing. You know, I'm looking at what's going to happen in the elections, and that's really depressing too. And I'm trying to pull something bright out of this. What are some possibilities going forward that might direct us towards a new deal?
Okay, why don't we take like two more questions and then give each person on the panel at least 5 minutes. That'll steal some from the beginning of lunch, right? But we can afford it, right?
Yes, I'm Kirsten Downey. I'm mainly here today to talk about Francis Perkins and the New Deal. But it happened that I was a reporter at the Washington Post from 2005 to 2008. And I'm now one of the writers on the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. So I wanted to tell you I'm actually walking a lot of these neighborhoods that we're talking about in the last few years. I walked the streets and looked at loans in Prince George's County. in Manassas in Virginia, all over the Washington area. I walked the neighborhoods that are most affected in Sacramento and Bakersfield and Cape Coral. I can tell you a lot of the people who got the original bad loans were indeed minorities, but everyone is being affected across the board, people of all races. This is a tragedy across the board because so many people bought in good faith in communities during the boom, at the periods of time that were shown to us on the chart. Their homes are worth half of what they paid. This is a disaster that's affecting everyone equally now.
Thank you. Yeah, Jim.
I missed a comment or two, so if I'm repeating, I apologize. I'm Jim Hawley, St. Mary's College, Center for the Study of Fiduciary Capitalism. One of the things that struck me, Neil, especially in your comments, but on a number of others as well, and I had a couple of very specific questions, which maybe we could talk about afterwards, having to do with the composition of who bought, who held, and the transfers involved, which I think is a critical question. But more generally, it strikes me that one of the things that hasn't been mentioned is that the overwhelming flow of funds, we could trace it, I think, probably post 01 or 02, but it goes back earlier, into not simply housing market a credit structured products, but in general, the growth of structured products and leverage throughout the financial system in the US as elsewhere has come from, in fact, something that should be core, I think, to the concern about is there a new deal? And that is to say, mutual funds, and that was clear in your, one of the graphs you threw up, but also public pension funds, TIF, CREF, and so on. And so the whole question, in my view at least, of where a huge amount of funds originate and the growth of alpha-seeking funds, especially in the last 10 years, is really a critical kind of question, which I think has to be addressed and underlies and facilitates, I think, a lot of the macro issues that that Robert mentioned, which I do see, unlike you, Neil, perhaps, as being very critically and closely integrated, not simply in housing market credit derivatives, but of all sorts, and the flow into so-called alternative investments and, relatively speaking, out of equity and fixed income. So I'd appreciate some comments on that.
All right. That's a good segue into letting the panelists in order, since you directed that one to Neil. To respond for, I'll give you about, say, 5 minutes each, and then we'll break for lunch.
Okay. Let me take some of this. Obviously, we only had 15 minutes. Sorry, so how much can you say? But let me just say something about the subprime holders. I start out my talk by saying that there's a lot we still don't know, and I think there is a lot we still don't know, including who were buying all of these. So I've seen all kinds of numbers and statistics, and there are people who are trying to analyze the actual mortgages themselves and who got those mortgages. But, you're talking about millions and millions and millions of mortgages over a long historical period, and these are hard to draw conclusions from. So, for example, you see numbers that at least a quarter of the people were speculators, right? Because you do have to remember that the housing market was going up, and so people were out there buying those condos in Florida, that those buildings that were just being built, thinking they were going to flip them before. And so a lot of these subprime mortgages were to people who were putting 0% down, thereby not investing any money in this. They were going to flip this thing on the thought that their $150,000 condo was going to be a $175,000 condo by then, and they were going to make money off the deal. And so there were minority communities. I don't want to say that didn't happen. The other thing that happened is that in California, especially because of the high housing prices in California, a lot of people were driven farther and farther out from the central cities. And if we look at those people, out on the other side of the hill here, and in Southern California, east of Los Angeles, which is in Riverside and San Bernardino and all those places, which were really hard hit, where we had these 50% drops in housing prices, they were middle class people. They weren't people in inner city communities. We don't actually have this all broken down. But I want to come back to my point about the banks. And I'm happy to take the correction about the financial sector, because I believe that they all did converge their model. And while there were still specialists out there, where there were people out there doing hedge funds who were basically doing derivative trading, blah, 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 the fact of the matter is that at the core of this, all of them had become oriented towards this market. And I think that here's two questions I would like to understand. One is, did the banks create the bubble? And let me explain what I mean by that. One of the things we know is that the banks were looking at zip code data, and they were looking at areas where there were rapid appreciations, and they were going out there to try to sell more mortgages into those areas. And the reason that we didn't have housing bubble all over the country, but only in certain kinds of places, is that it was those places that were going up where the banks came in and were maybe even, you know, trying to goose the thing up. We don't know that. We don't know. And maybe some of you think I'm paranoid for saying that, but this is something that probably happened, that the banks were driving this as well as reacting to it. And we also don't know, let me say another thing about what the banks were doing. The investment banks were actually buying subprime and other mortgage originators in this period, 2002 to 2008. And one of the main reasons they were doing it is because they were being cut off from mortgages that they could then repackage and sell off into these securities. So the real money was in the selling, the packaging of the securities and the selling of the securities and the holding of the securities. But if you didn't have mortgages, then it wasn't going to work. So what you had to do is you had to buy up the supply chain to buy yourself a mortgage originator. And Lehman and Bear Stearns and they all were doing it. And this is, if you look at my paper that's out there, you'll see evidence for this. This is what they were doing in order to keep the party going. And so I think at this point, we don't know who they were totally selling them to. We don't know exactly what they were doing. And we still don't exactly understand how their particular meltdown has now affected everything else. And so I think that where I was, my sort of dig at macroeconomics was that I think people think that, and Bernanke thinks, that if he starts doing this thing he's going to do, he's going to solve the problem. But what I'm saying is I don't see that happening because the core of this economy, which is based to a large degree around housing and mortgages and consumer expenditures and stuff like that, isn't going to respond to this because of the kinds of things that we heard this morning. So I'll let...
Okay, Neil, that was excellent, not only in time, but in responding to my desire to have some research questions posed by everyone, too. John.
Let me briefly respond to two issues that have been raised, one about the regulation and the mortgage market and the other about policy going forward. I think it's not hard to think of a realignment of incentives which would have made a great deal of difference in the way the difficulties in the mortgage market played out over the last several years. The notion that every actor in the chain of origination through securitization was paid at the time a contract was signed as compared to any notion of the performance of the underlying contract seems to have been a big mistake, to say the least. For example, there's no reason why a regulation going forward would say that originators would be paid over some reasonable period on the performance of the underlying asset, or going a little further, that originators would be required to post bonds so that in the event that the contract went sour, some plaintiff's lawyer would have an incentive to litigate this case on behalf of the contract. And you can play that all the way through the system, from the originator to the issuance of the mortgage to the securitization, and that performance ought to be on some long-term contract. Another example of this, of course, is the securitization process where tranches of double B mortgages could be repackaged into securities that were rated AAA, and the raters would have no responsibility to hold excess capital as a result of this. So it was really sort of turning dross into gold. So there are lots of things that one could think of that would improve the regulatory structure. The issue of predatory borrowers, well, I think everyone in this room, no one in this room is more than three instances away from somebody who bought 12 condos in Florida. So there are lots of predatory
lenders in this circumstance, but there are also some predatory borrowers as well, and it was not hard to see that incentives worked for both sides of this market to their detriment. Finally, on that kind of question of why the policies have worked so inadequately since 2008, since the Bush administration started, and these innovations by the Obama administration. I think the strong argument as to why these things have been so complicated is that securitization has made these the process of renegotiation much more complicated and more difficult. That's the story that's currently told. I'm not sure I believe that, actually, because it's very clear that the guys that are the holders in due course, who then provide that post the monthly payments, they have everybody's address. They have people's emails address. It's not hard if you wanted to get the servicers and the lenders in the same room together with borrowers to strike a deal if it were in their interest. But I think the point and the thing that's become clear over the last 9 months or so is that it's just not in the interest of those who make the mortgages to renegotiate them. And I think the kind of awful truth is that of mortgages which have been modified, if I modify a mortgage, about 55% of them go 90 days delinquent within 18 months. What that basically says is that half the money that the bank would spend to modify a mortgage is wasted, because these guys are modified mortgages are going to cure, and mortgages that are delinquent are going to default, and so it's not in anybody's in any lender's self interest to do that. So you have to pay them a lot more. Or else you have to, by some regulation, cram down the values of the mortgages. So I think that what we've seen in the administration's program is unfortunately self-defeating. And as long as a large number of modified mortgages would self-cure anyway, and a lot of modified mortgages default subsequently, then the incentive for those who are actually issuing the mortgages to renegotiate is quite low.
Thank you, John. Doug?
I'd like to respond to 3 points. Well, first of all, I'm wondering exactly where the pressure for austerity is coming from, the political pressure for austerity and budget cutting. As far as I can tell, the big Wall Street houses are not enthusiastic. Certainly their economic staff has been supporting the stimulus package, would even support further fiscal stimulus. You know, I read the Goldman Sachs daily economic updates, and you know, they're actually pro-stimulus. They're not pro-budget cutting. So is it coming from the Republican Party? Where within the Republican Party, some sort of provincial petty bourgeoisie that supports the Republican Party? Is it coming from the Fortune 500? I don't really quite understand where this pressure for austerity is coming from. As Rob pointed out, do they want to create a depression, or do they actually think that cutting budgets is good for economic growth? I would love to know the answer to that question. I think that's a topic, rich topic for further research. And taking it beyond these borders, why does it seem like Germany, or at least the German elite, or the Bundesbank, or whoever it is that is responsible for these things, Angela Merkel, I don't know, wants to drive the periphery of Europe into depression? Do they have stand to gain some material benefit from this? Is it ideology? Is it sadism? I don't really quite understand what they're after. You know, if you look at what's happened in Ireland, which is going now into its beyond its second year of austerity, Irish bond yields are rising, not falling, because there's more anxiety that Ireland is going to be unable to service its debts because what budget cuts they've had already have only driven the economy deeper into crisis and have not turned things around by any means. And now they're going, instead of reversing course, they're going on a second round of budget cutting. Where is this coming from? Where is the pressure for this coming from? It does seem nearly insane. So is it really a misunderstanding, or is there some actual benefit that some elites can gain from this kind of policy? I don't know. I wish somebody could enlighten me. Second, on the Obama question, I'd be happy to be pretty mean about him. I think he's a great disappointment. I didn't expect all that much from him, but as I said in my talk, I thought he'd be at least more of a Teddy Roosevelt kind of figure, bringing some degree of rationality to the system. Certainly didn't expect him to be Franklin Roosevelt, but he could have been at least some kind of Teddy. And I can see why there are differences why he's not FDR. Certainly the economy is not in as bad shape. You know, the unemployment rate is 10%, not 25%. There's less memory of an existing left now than there was the people who staffed the Roosevelt administration. And there's also a personality issue. FDR came out of the aristocracy and had much more personal confidence about stepping on their toes. Somebody pointed out to me he's also a member of a kind of landowning aristocracy and had contempt for financiers, so even you know, interclass dislike. But anyway, I think he had the personal confidence to take on elites in a way that Obama didn't. Obama is a creature who was groomed by and adopted by elites. You remember that famous speech in 1936 where FDR lined up all the forces that were against him and said, "I welcome their hatred." You can't imagine Obama saying something like that. He craves their love. He's very, very much, you know, this is the guy who said that Jamie Dimon is a savvy businessman. Don't want to personalize this too much, but the way I like to put it is the Democratic Party has a real structural problem that it is fundamentally a business party that for electoral reasons has to pretend otherwise sometimes. So that is the reason for what it sometimes appears to be its weakness and all the contortions and compromises. But it really is trying to serve two masters, one master, just an occasional pretend master. And it makes them look weak and silly very often. And I think that's responsible for their rather poor performance in office so far. But, you know, just in purely marketing terms, as Rob pointed out, you know, product differentiation, I happen to be listening, for some reason I don't fully understand, to Ronald Reagan's first inaugural address the other day. It's in my iTunes library, and there it was, Reagan. And I was quite struck by the way Reagan made a point of saying, we can't go back to the failed policies of the past. We have to go through some pain now. It's very unpleasant, but we can't go back to that way of doing things. And he explained it in his simple but very effective and persuasive way. You know, there were times when I was listening to Reagan, I would almost go, oh, yeah. He's got a point. And then I stopped myself. But, you know, he was very good at doing that sort of thing. Obama has never done anything remotely like that. You know, he's not been able to say, we went through some really bad times and we have to do things differently and there's a pain in this transition. He's never really explained that in any way that the public can understand. He's never explained why this recession was so severe. He could talk about the structural issues that created this problem. But in part because he wants to placate and even subsidize the very forces that created the problem, he is unable to deliver that kind of product differentiation message, much to the regret of many who are looking to next Tuesday as a day of doom. But I think, you know, it was entirely to be expected given the politics of this. And finally, on the point about race that Fred Block made. It's true, race certainly mattered in all this. If you do your regressions and you know, find similarly situated people who are only differentiated by race, the black applicant was more likely to be steered to a subprime mortgage than a white applicant. That's all true. There's certainly neighborhoods not far from where I live in southern Queens and central Brooklyn where the racial dynamic was very important, but that is also not very important in ex-urban areas of Las Vegas or Southern California or Florida, you know, so Arizona, Phoenix, you know, this is not was not a racial issue there. But also, as a political matter, I want to channel my friend and someone I admire very much, Adolf Reed, in saying, what kind of political point does that lead to? You make the point about race, and it really just ends up being kind of a moral or spiritual or psychological point, but it doesn't really tell you what you can do about it. It doesn't lead to any kind of political agenda. And Reed contrasts the agenda of the early civil rights movement, which is very focused on specific demands on the state about citizenship, about voting rights, and about a social democratic and pro-labor agenda as well. Yeah, that had a real political point a political agenda. I don't know what making the point about race in this kind of issue would do except to say, gee, that's terrible, and aren't we bad? And we are, and it's terrible, and we're bad, but I don't know what you do about that exactly. And Adolf also points out, though, that a lot of preachers and community organizations in black communities were pushing subprime lending as a way of uplift and economic empowerment. So it's not just a matter of bad white racists, although there were plenty of those around. I'll leave it there. Thanks.
Thank you. Rob?
I'll start with Michael's question about the depth of the crisis in the banks. I looked at this crisis as Bear Stearns was approaching. I was doing some consulting for banks, and I always try to simplify things and so that it really hinges upon leverage and complexity. In essence, leverage is how far you're going to fall down. It's like how high you are on the ladder tells you how much you can get hurt when you fall. But the complexity is the thing that I think surprised everybody. Once the system is shocked, everybody goes into this musical chairs game. And at the time, I remember talking to them in the CFO's office at Citigroup, and the guy's looking at me and he says, you know what's really stressful? We have no idea what we're worth. And we settle trillions of dollars every night with all the other big investment banks and banks. We have no idea what they're worth. And none of us can prove that we're solvent or insolvent. And we're settling trillions of dollars on faith every night. And as we saw in that period, the gridlock, the persistent dysfunction of money markets and interbank markets went on and on and on, really till beyond Lehman Brothers, where the Fed became what you might call a hub-and-spoke model, where everybody's counterparty became the Fed, and they stopped dealing with each other. And I think the complexity and the inability, what you might call the collective pollution of complexity and the inability to infer whether you were solvent as a counterparty or not, really was at the core of the depth and the duration of that experience. So I always go back to my Bob Dylan lyric book when I'm trying to figure out what's going on. And there was a very simple in All Along the Watchtower. He said, none of them along the line know what any of it is worth. By the way, for those of you that are fans of Too Big to Fail, there's no success like failure, and failure's no success at all. Michael then asked about what would raise living standards. And I think there's a constellation of things to look at. Basic science research, Newsweek's recent report suggests the United States is 30th in basic science research. Bill Lozonik's book that won the Schumpeter Prize this year, Sustainable Growth for a New Economy, talks about how all of our communications technology, information communications technology industries are cutting back their R&D spending very, very significantly. One could study the, and I haven't, but early stage capital markets and their functioning. If we're going to subsidize the big guys, we ought to look at what happens at the end of the spectrum, where more job creation takes place. Education spending, probably government reform. Infrastructure spending, creating a public platform. As I listened to Dean talking about what you might call the components of the savings investment balance, and you asked, I believe that you were surprised the private sector isn't, whether it's households or firms, isn't saving even more. Yeah. But the investment with low capacity utilization isn't likely to be bursting forth, and it really becomes the government's role, which takes us back to these political problems and gridlock if there is to be a way out. Let's see, other thoughts that, however, you mentioned deregulation. I think the other thing that isn't mentioned is that people didn't enforce the regulations they did have. And so at some level, giving new rules to people that don't use those rules is a problem. We have a serious problem with what you might call the opportunity cost of doing good. Senior officials at the SEC and others, if they're rational beings, they carry their resume in their pocket because the amount of money that they could get from when they pay a supervisory visit from changing sides is enormous. And Tom Ferguson and I did a paper for the INET conference that looks at the history of that and the widening opportunity cost of remaining a valiant public servant. I'm going to join Doug's comments with regard to Fred Block's comments about Obama.
You know, you said something, Fred, about all the left and populist stuff. I'm not talking about left and populist. I'm talking about fairness. The guy didn't step up and represent the American people with fairness. When he stood there and said, Jamie Dimon and Lloyd Blankfein, nobody resents them for their wealth. Come on. I'll bet you about 92% of the population resents them for their wealth. When he said they're paid the same as baseball players, my wife looked at me. She's looking at this on television. She looks at me and she says, when was the last time Alex Rodriguez blew a $5 trillion hole in the world economy? When you look at Celinda Lake's polls when Scott Brown was elected in January in bonus week of 2010, when Coakley lost to Scott Brown, all of the data that came out of that was about fairness, bank bonuses, and bank bailouts. I think Obama was dealt a terrible hand, and I think he's a well-meaning guy. And I think the role of money politics, I remember the New York Times actually writing an article about how all the fundraisers were shifting to the Republican side in the same week he made that comment about the baseball players. I mean, I think they're in a structural problem. And when I go back to your question about what raises living standards, I think we need very significant government reform, particularly in the aftermath of the FEC Citizens United decision, I think is very important. Let me see if there was one other note. On the austerity question, what do they want? I just would point people, I think somebody did this yesterday too, the IMF's latest World Economic Outlook actually takes on the Alessina and Ardagna line of thought, as do my colleagues Mike Consul and Arjun Jayadev at the Roosevelt Institute. And as I put it in a forthcoming working paper with Tom Ferguson, if you were advising Tim Geithner and you took Alessina and Ardagna's stuff apart, and you said, we're a large reserve currency already with zero interest rates, we can't afford to drop the dollar 40%, of the 107 cases they identify, I called it the sinker pitch in the draft of this working paper. You're going to throw a sinker, which means you know, cut the budget deficit. What's the chance you're going to get expansionary growth? And we dissect the 107 cases, and the probabilities I would hand Secretary Geithner is 0 out of 107. There is no case when, in the aftermath, either the real exchange rate didn't drop by 30% or more, or interest rates didn't drop 700 or 800 basis points. In response to the contractionary structural change. And it was all essentially small economies like Norway, Ireland, or Portugal that were involved. Finally, I think the key question for political economy right now, and I do view these things as highly integrated, is why could we have a New Deal coalition and why can't we organically create one now? It's not... Like, I mean, you read Brad DeLong's blog. You read any number of things, Paul Krugman's blog. The playbook has been invented, and we do have the benefit of experience, but we don't have a coalition. And I go back, final note, to the Davos man. There are an awful lot of people now that don't need educated American workers. They don't need American people to be healthy. They don't need much infrastructure here. They're making enough money, they got private security, private transportation, private schooling, and their business success, as you mentioned in the venture capital community, where I'm doing a lot of work and interviewing, depends upon how things are going in China and India. And the real question at some level is these people are corporate executives or individual entrepreneurs that are the wealthiest segment, the people who pay for campaign finance. Why do they, as rational beings, want to pay for the society we all need? It's up to us, with our votes and with our participation, to make it untenable for these people not to give it to us. Thanks.
Okay. I want to break for lunch in a minute, but since I've been teasing Neil all morning, I'm going to give him another 30 seconds for one point.
I just wanted to say that one of the things that people raised and we didn't talk much about was regulation. And I think this is another place where a bunch of research needs to be done, because I think we have two images here. One is this image that there was this deregulation and nobody was paying attention. And then the other is that we have this image of regulatory capture. And both of those things can't be true, if you follow what I'm saying. We can't have had that these guys were just, go ahead, do whatever you want, that's fine. or not paying any attention or something like that. Or on the other hand, that the bankers in the Simon Johnson version of this are in there telling them, you know, let's, you know, this is what we want, and we're going to get it, let's do it. And I think that that's in this whole discussion about financial regulation, I think trying to figure out where the truth is in there is a really important question.
Okay.
I just have a couple of announcements for those people who arrived late. If you have a session this afternoon, please see me, because you have something to put on the computer for slides. We need to have you work with Robert to have them on the computer. Coffee cups in here with a lid. Lunch is served in the other room, so please help yourself. And there's signs for the bathroom. If you need anything, please talk to me or Myra.
Okay. Thank you very much, everybody.